Welcome to Sacred Realms. It's a great day in Hyrule, y'all. Welcome to Sacred Realms, a Zelda retrospective podcast. I am your host, Lyndon Willoughby. I'm joined, as always, by my co-host, Matt Willoughby. Matt, it is a day of much rejoicing. A great day of much rejoicing.
You better put in the Monty Python drop there. It is indeed a day for much rejoicing, and although
notable for being the first time that we have seen our brother Jackson in person in two and a half years.
We haven't seen him since he was here last time. Not at all.
Where has he been? We don't know.
I'm totally kidding. We of course have seen him many times, but
seen him all the time.
He is present and accounted for, sitting next to me so that I have to lean over at an awkward angle so that we can share a microphone, which is less than ideal, but these are the sacrifices we make for family.
The third piece of the Willoughby Triforce. Ladies and gentlemen, Mr. Jackson Willoughby joins us on the show again tonight. How you doing, Jackson?
I am wonderful right now. Also, just buy a third mic for your guest if you don't
want
this problem.
There's only two ports on the hub is the problem. Otherwise, we totally would do that.
And we need a bigger hub. We need a better hub. We need another microphone. Basically, we just need to revamp our equipment selection, which we've said, I think, for like 3 months now.
So actually, Focusrite does make a Scarlett audio hub that has like four outputs, I think. So,
well, I think we should probably get that.
I was going to say, we might need to up our investment in the recording technology sometime before too long. But anyway, that's a little inside baseball on the recording of pod. Getting back to Mr. Jackson Willoughby, how have things been going? I mean, we haven't caught up with you on the podcast in quite a long time.
Well, things have been really awesome as of late. I am currently now engaged, which I was not previously. So that was an exciting development in my life just a couple weeks ago. And couldn't be happier about that. And work is going great.
We celebrated that happening on the pod last week. So
we did. We gave you and your fiance a good old shout out. But now we'll shout you out again because it's a huge life achievement and we're very proud of you. And
we
love her. And hooray.
Yay.
Yeah. Well, cool. Life stuff aside, we're definitely super thrilled to have you back on the podcast. I think we were talking about this week and trying to remember when the last time you were on was, and it was A Link to the Past season, right?
Yeah, it was A Link to the Past. And that was actually a really fun episode that we did, which is great that I waited all this time to come back for basically A Link to the Past part two.
Right, exactly. Or Triforce of the Gods part two, as they call it in Japan.
Yeah, exactly.
Right. So, that does make it very appropriate. Do you happen to remember off the top of your head which dungeon you talked about in A Link to the Past?
Yeah, I was the final dungeon. It was the last.
Oh, Ganon's Castle?
Yes.
Gotcha. Cool.
Falling through the ceiling, all that stuff.
Was, you sure that wasn't Ice Palace?
No, I'm sure it's in the underworld.
Oh, when you fall,
you fall down in the pyramid. Yeah.
Okay, cool.
I remember what
gotcha.
He's talking about.
Yeah.
Good, Igor.
Not the one with Igor.
Not
Igor the Block. Not at all. Well, cool.
Well, Lyndon, cool. Before we get into video game stuff, what are you drinking tonight?
We haven't done that bit on Sacred Realms in a while, it's a little bit different now.
Actually, we have a bit of a departure with tradition that's happening right now. Matt and I are both doing this new thing where we try not drinking during the week. We're
drinking alcohol. Yeah. We drink water, but alcohol.
We're still consuming liquids, but yeah, trying to lower that intake just a little bit for the health of the body. Does the body good? So that's definitely a new thing. I don't know if it's going to stick forever, but currently we're kind of aligning with the church calendar. It's Lent season right now, so we're...
And that was more or less accidental, but fortuitously timed, I think.
Yeah.
It gave an excuse.
Yes.
Did give an excuse. So regardless, we're still smoking a stogie out here, and you got to pair your stogie with something. And the youngest Willoughby brother had a truly fantastic and spectacular recommendation, which was to pair it with a nice coffee, which is a thing. It's a thing that people do. Coffee and stogies have long gone together. Hobbyists enjoy them both in at the same
time.
In tandem. So Jackson brought Matt and I over each a cigar and then a coffee to pair it with. So I got to say, it's truly a delicious pairing.
It is delectable, one might say.
One might say. I'm saying.
I am also saying, yes.
Okay, we are one.
I had to ask just to shout myself out, right?
That's true. You were fishing for compliments there. We see what you were doing.
But the people need to know. The people need to know that this is a thing, because if you didn't know, then obviously there are others out there who did not.
I do think it's pretty funny that, like, the biggest whiskeysman that I know, the first night that you're back on the podcast after 2.5 years is also the first time that we're not drinking whiskey while we record it.
Oh, well, believe me, I still brought 4 bottles, so...
Well, you are not. Yeah, I was about to say you are not beholden to these rules.
You are not.
And when he says he brought 4 bottles, he's not planning on drinking all 4 bottles during this recording.
What can I say? I like a selection. You know, you got to have multiple things to choose from. You don't know exactly what you're going to be feeling at any given time, so I just brought a few things out.
That's what makes you a connoisseur.
Always come prepared.
And better to have it and not need it than want it and not have it.
Yeah, nope, that's true.
Same principle as a... what's that principle? It. What's that principle about, Lyndon?
It's a contraceptive device. anywho, so with that being said, the funny thing is we usually record on Sunday nights, so that's totally game for some whiskey-age, and I dare say that we'll probably be drinking whiskey on the pod again next time or the time after that or something.
Yeah, well, I thought we were doing school nights, so Sunday night technically is out of bounds.
Oh, yeah, I guess that's fair. Okay, yep. Well, never mind.
Yep, it's got to be Friday or Saturday.
How about this? If it's Sunday night, then you can't have whiskey, but maybe you could have 1 beer or a glass of wine. You know, something that's like a little bit of that gray area, right? Because
like
it is
a wine down,
but only if it's a podcasting night. Yes, there we go.
A wine down. I like that.
That's good. Yeah.
We got to workshop this a little bit more. We can talk about it more this coming weekend while we celebrate the return of Formula One to our TV screens. Hey-o!
And this is the part of the podcast where we lose half of our audience who doesn't care about sports.
I wonder if any of our listeners do follow Formula One. I don't see people talking about it in the Discord, but it's kind of getting big right now. I don't know.
Yeah, we have a decent amount of like football, a couple baseball, and then a couple our international friends do some of the football occasionally. But that's the extent of sportsmanship that I've seen on there.
Well, if you are indeed a listener of Sacred Realms Pod and you are also a fan of the Formula Ones, let us know. We like to seek those people out so that we can talk about the same thing, share common interests. It's a good thing to do.
Absolutely.
But this is neither a alcohol podcast, a coffee podcast, a cigar podcast, or a Formula One podcast. It's also not a Star Trek podcast. It occasionally sounds like all of those things.
I was about to say.
It is none of those things.
We dip our toes in those waters so frequently that some people could be forgiven for thinking we're just a generic podcast. But
what it is, however, is a Zelda retrospective podcast.
We are that. Yes, indeed. It's in the title. It's right there.
It's right there. And so with that now being stated up front, I believe it's time to talk about some Zelda.
I think that sounds like fun to me.
We played another fun section this week, and of course, we have to get the part out of the way where we catch up with Jackson and his thoughts on the game up until now, since this is his first appearance on the season. Before we do all of that, though, let's get into the housekeeping, get it out of the way. That way we won't have to worry about it later. If you didn't know, Sacred Realms is a weekly re-examination of The Legend of Zelda, one little slice at a time. Sacred Realms drops every Wednesday and is available on all major podcast networks. Every week, we play a new section of a Zelda game, and then we sit down here to talk and to drop our hot takes. If that sounds fun to you, please head over to Apple Podcasts, hit that subscribe button, and be sure to leave us a review. 5-star reviews are greatly appreciated, and they have a chance to get a shout-out here on the show. If you want more Sacred Realms in your life, you can head over to patreon.com/sacredrealmspod to get access to our Discord channel, listener mail, vote on what game we play next, and much more. Additionally, one of the benefits that Master Sword patrons and above get is that we read their names every week here on the show. Those legendary individuals are Shepherd Street, Matthew, Chris, Daniel, Fallout 907, Kelso, Tiffany the Star, Daxel, Patrice, Stephanie, Darknuck, Brian, George, Mike, Dylan, Allie, Lennon, Melanie, Kolku, Aiden, Rowan, Josh, Nick, Dante, Gep, Brittany, Davey, Haru the Mighty, Derek, Albert, Mark, Andy, Cameron, Ben, Daniel, NickD_TV, Travis, Christian, Jonathan, Hyrule Interviews, aka Max Nichols, Garrett, and Drew. These are the most legendary of individuals. I would follow them into a dangerous looking fan filled dungeon any day of the week. But without further ado, let's start talking about what we came here to talk about, which is The Legend of Zelda, A Link Between Worlds. Before we get into the Sacred Realms rundown, Jackson, I want to give you just a little bit of time to answer one or two questions for us. So as this is your first appearance on the season, I want to catch up with your history with this game specifically, kind of where you're at with it leading up to this point in the game, stuff like that. So let's start with that first one. Have you ever played A Link Between Worlds before?
No, this is my first time playing this game. And as you know, it can be quite the hassle to acquire this game. And luckily, I was able to find a copy locally to me that I was able to purchase. So I do have a local copy rather than having to do the workaround to download it. Which was great. Now, immediately upon booting up this game, the graphics are great, but they're very different from most Zelda games. I think this fits in a really interesting niche, not only in its style, but also because of the time that this game came out. It's like right around, like it's kind of in no man's land. You know, it's this and then Breath of the Wild.
Right.
So I like the art style and the music is great. And I've had a lot of fun playing it. I kind of went through it pretty fast and, you know, really didn't put it down for a few hours to just run through everything. But I didn't have a problem with that. I thought it was great.
And you feel so you probably played for about what, 3.5, 4 hours?
Yeah, about 4 hours.
OK. And would you say that that was like and that wasn't like a super brisk play either? Like you were leaving time to poke around and do stuff, right?
Yeah. So, you know, you walk around the village and you go to a few different locations. And obviously before you get access to the witch, you have a lot of backtracking to do. So, yeah, I had a lot of fun. I like, it's a perfect size.
And when we say the witch, we're referring of course to Irene and not the A24 indie horror film, The Vavitch.
Oh God, that movie was not good.
I've actually not seen it. I've heard that it's good, but I've heard it's very much a film.
It is a film that our friend the Schweez would disdain.
Yeah.
If that gives you any context.
Yeah.
Which it gives you context. It does not give the listeners context.
None of these people context.
No, they don't know what we're talking about, but yeah.
But yeah, I think that the map is a really decent size. It's just big enough to feel like you're exploring without being too big as to be annoying to walk around.
Yeah.
There's really only one thing I did other than the missions, which was I did the Cuckoo minigame, which I was horrifically bad at and immediately stopped after losing 3 times in a row to cut my losses. But no, I had a good time. And I think that the story is interesting.
Yeah.
And all of the buildings are really nice. I like what they did with the castle this time. It's a little bit different and I like it.
Yeah. Well, and that's kind of what I was going to ask you because you and Matt are unique. From my experience with this game in that you both played A Link to the Past before you played this game for the first time. I did not. I played this game before I ever played A Link to the Past. And so what I was kind of wondering from you is like, obviously, I don't think you have a lot of nostalgia for A Link to the Past. But did you get are you getting anything extra out of this experience having been familiar with that overworld already?
Yes. Diagonal movement is
that's what it all comes back to.
It's a necessity. It's those little creature comforts, right? And I like The Link to the Past, but this just feels like if that game was made when it was in 2014, which is exactly what happened, right? So I think it's a great way of bringing a great game into the future and changing it just enough to where it feels different, but you can obviously tell it's very much based around that old Link to the Past. So, about that thing that makes it so different is, you know, being the painting and being able to go onto the walls and merge and things like that. I oftentimes forget entirely that I can do it. And so I will spend 5 minutes being like, why, how do I get over to this area? Like, for instance, jumping ahead a little bit to get to Zora's domain, you have to merge into the wall. And I, for some reason,
took you a minute.
Yes. I don't know why. And then I walked up to the wall and it said merge. And I was like, of course, like, how did I not think of this? This is the whole premise of the game. And it happened a couple times in the House of Gales as well, where you're like, why do I keep just going in circles? How do I get this stupid key that's sitting dangling on a pipe? How do I get there? And of course, finally, you're like, of course, just merge into the wall. The whole point of the game, the main mechanic, which was a little embarrassing.
I will say that I did something more embarrassing, which was I talked to the Zora that was next to the ledge, and he said, oh, I saw a dude just like hop over it after sprinting. And I was like, oh, cool. I need to go get the Pegasus boots so that I can hop this ledge,
which would be a pretty classic, like that paired with like a rock's feather or something.
Yeah,
that's normally how you would. Yeah. Try to solve this, right?
And so I went back to Kakariko Village and tried to, like, rob the shady guy a whole bunch of times before realizing that that wasn't going to work. And so I went back and, like, tried to jump it twice, and of course it didn't work. And then I said, what the hell am I doing? Emerged into the wall and just skirted across it. And there we go. Problem solved.
Well, I'm glad I'm not the only one. I think the other main thing before we really get into this section of game, a general rule that I've found about this game and a few other Zeldas is the repeatable talking to certain people that you just have to click through every time, specifically with Ravi when you go and you have to rent weapons. And he gives you the same spiel every time. And it's like four panes of text that you have to click through. And you're like, my gosh, just let me rent the weapon and leave.
There's the NPCs in this game are talky. I will give you that. That's something that I was noticing this week, too.
I accidentally talked to the street pass guy twice in this section of game, and also talked to
Gramps.
Yeah, I talked to Gramps, and I also talked to Papa on the other side of Kakariko Village near the bottom, because I was like, yeah, maybe he'll have something interesting to say. And he also tried to talk to me about the street pass, and I was about to murder everyone in Kakariko Village. I don't care about the street pass.
There is a, that's a relic of a bygone era. That's one of Nintendo's early fumbling attempts at online functionality, which they're kind of still fumbling.
Yep.
But
all basically perpetually, yes.
Yeah. There's actually a popular fan theory that Gramps is the Link from A Link to the Past.
Really?
Yeah, because he's wearing green and...
Oh, that would be kind of neat.
I don't know. Yeah, I don't know.
I like that.
A little headcanon there.
We'll take it.
But actually, the way that works, though, because I've done it before, and it probably still works, you can load into fights that he hosts with an AI Dark Link.
I'm sorry, say that again?
So Gramps, his whole thing, he hosts fights. I think, here, let me see if I can remember how this works. You can basically load into fights with an AI Dark Link.
Oh, that's pretty neat.
You can fight him.
It's a training session, yeah.
Hold on.
Do you, like, get anything for it, or it's just for kind of funsies?
Let me look it up.
So, if I remember correctly, IIRC, the talk that he gives you basically says, you take whatever you want in there, and you get rewards for beating him, but if you lose, you don't lose anything. So there's everything to gain and nothing to lose, I think is almost exactly what he tells you. So there's like little rewards you probably get, just like rupees or potion or something like that. But it's more of just like a training session and something extra fun to do outside of the main storyline. Considering that I haven't really found a whole lot extra to do other than the collection that's in this game. And then the cuckoo game. Those are the only two things. And then I guess they were like, oh, let's add this little training feature. That might be fun.
Okay, so here we go. Gramps is a character that appears in A Link Between Worlds. He's an elderly citizen in charge of the game's Street Pass functionality, Shadow Link battles, and stands in the Street Pass meadow on the western side of Kakariko Village. Gramps also acts as a secret boss. Once all 50 challenge medals have been collected, Gramps can be challenged to a duel in a similar fashion to fighting a Shadow Link. He wields upgraded versions of all the items and gear available to Link.
Well, that's pretty cool. So, what do you get for beating him?
Medals. It's a collectathon of things. It's, well, you know.
Okay.
So I have a question. Does the difficulty increase on hero mode? Because on hero mode, that sounds like a pain to beat him.
So, okay. I'm not sure. This is actually a very long article about how all this works, and I don't know. I'm going to tell you what. I'm going to do some research on this, and I am going to dabble in this system before we record our next episode.
That is commitment to the pod.
And we'll chat about it just a little bit, and we'll see if there's anything fun to get into there. Who knows? Maybe I'll enjoy it. But anyway, that was a big, long rabbit trail about Gramps.
So getting back to the game.
Well, that was technically part of the game.
Yeah, but the story more specifically. My last thought before we get to House of Gales is about Osfala. Is that his name?
Osfala.
Yes. This man, what a legend. He obviously is quite incapable of the skills that he believes he has, and yet still manages to get all the way to the final boss in the first dungeon. And I'm like, if this man has been set up to us as a big buffoon, how did he get that far?
Well, I'm just wondering, what was that sand rod even doing for him in that dungeon?
Does anyone know what the sand rod does? Because yeah, I don't.
You use it to create elevated columns of sand in the desert palace.
Do you think he just like used it to lift his way over all the obstacles and just like walked himself all the way there?
There has to be sand there to use it. Like,
oh,
that's what I'm saying. I have no idea like what this was doing for him. So there you go. Osfala is not one of the world's great warriors, clearly.
No, not the most intelligent of beings.
Yeah. So that's all story talk. I want to talk a little bit about the gameplay of A Link Between Worlds, because you had a very interesting observation that you brought up to me while we were inside. And it's something that I had never really considered about this game before, but I thought it was just really cool. It's got me thinking about A Link Between Worlds in kind of a completely new way. So why don't you drop that on us real quick? Because it's applicable to everything we've done before now as well.
Yeah. This is what I believe to be the first Zelda platformer. It's all about climbing levels. The dungeons so far have all been climbing towers, going up in floors, and you have to find out the puzzle way to get up. And I think that that's really interesting. And some dungeons so far have done a better job of that than others. But
So you're right. Just to acknowledge the first thing that's going to come to everybody's mind, yes, Zelda 2 is very much a platformer as well, but
we all hate Zelda 2.
But a side-scrolling platformer, though, and I wouldn't even necessarily call it a platformer, really. And in some ways, so platformer in the strictest sense is much more, I think people think about like Mario, for instance, right? That's much more about just world traversal and. Kind of overcoming like obstacles and being defensive while things are just trying to run into you, basically, right? So in that sense, it's not a platforming game. It is an adventure game, but that platforming influence, that verticality, that like ascension through the levels, and the emphasis that this game has on moving from one platform to another platform and traversing that way, I think that's a really interesting observation that had not occurred to me. And I'm going to be paying attention to that throughout the entire rest of the game now.
I mean, I think that that is really cool way to look at it. And I like it a lot. I am going to definitely do the same thing. That's a very solid observation there.
And you have a great point. And as far as I can remember, it's very it's one of the things that gives this game a very unique feel from most, really all other Zeldas, you know? I think that this world, like the world of A Link Between Worlds, the dungeons, the puzzles that are in them, everything is so much more mobile than we're used to getting in a lot of Zelda games, simply because the main mechanic is, you know, moving, but like moving over gaps via the wall and, you know, things elevating you to another level, you know, after having done that. It's a very interesting point.
No, and I think Tower of Hera, honestly, spoiler alert, is probably my favorite way of showing this. A lot of it has to do with timing your springs. And House of Gales does this as well. But I thought that Tower of Hera did a really great job with this. The way that you have to time your springs to get on moving platforms and and things like that, I thought were really interesting. I liked it a bit more than the fan system in House of Gales, but I think they both did a fantastic job at giving this game what you call a very unique feel. It is very different from the other Zelda games that I've played, for sure.
Certainly other top-down Zelda games.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. This game fits a interesting niche, like I said earlier, partially because of its graphics and partially because of its movement. It gives a almost 3D feel, especially in the cutscenes, but giving the top-down experience in a new way that we haven't had before from this franchise.
Yep. Cool. Love it. Bringing the fire already, Jackson. It's good stuff. Really good pod happening right here. All right. Well, I think that's enough preamble. Let's go ahead and get into the Sacred Realms Rundown, which is a 6-part analysis of what we played this week and the feelings that it made us feel. Today, we are covering A Link Between Worlds Chapter 3. Part 1 of the Sacred Realms Rundown is, as always, the plot recap, tonight read by Matt. Take it away, Matt.
With 2 pendants in hand, we have only 1 more to go until we prove our worthiness to wield the legendary blade. Hopefully, it is not too late to stop Yuga from freeing Ganon, but we have no way to know how far his plans have progressed until we can breach the castle using the Master Sword. So we head directly to the House of Gales that Sahasrara marked on the south section of the map. Unfortunately, the House of Gales seems to be in the middle of the lake, which we can't reach because we can't swim. There's a gentleman on a small island in the middle of the lake who tells us that he learned the noble art of swimming from the Zora people, who reside up in the northeast part of Hyrule. Taking his advice, we head up to the witch's house, where we have seen a Zora hanging out near a ledge. We talk to this fellow who says that the bridge leading to Zora's domain was destroyed by the earthquake, and that the gap is too large to jump. But using our wall merge ability, we make it across and head further north. We reach Zora's domain after making it past a few rando monsters, and before we can head into the cave through the entrance under the waterfall, a random stranger runs headlong into us at incredible speed. It is none other than the shady stranger who has been loitering around Kakariko Village. He gets up and quickly darts off to parts unknown. We head inside Zora's domain to find the Zora people in dismay, and their queen swelled to an enormous size. In overhearing their chatter, we learn that the shady dude has stolen something called a smooth gem, which helps the queen contain some of her powers and prevents her from becoming this monster in front of us. It seems that we will get nothing out of the Zora people while their queen is in this state, so we head off to chase down this ne'er-do-well in Kakariko Village. Once we get there, we find the guy near the northern entrance of the village, but as soon as he sees us, he sprints off at his normal, unbelievable speed. We hang out around the corner until he returns to his loitering spot, and then we use our wall merge ability to sneak up behind him, close enough so that he can't run away from us again. As soon as we come out of the wall and hold the thief at sword point, he starts spewing confessions and apologies as fast as he can. He tells us about the boots he has that allow him to run so fast, and that the power that they give him has tempted him to become this lowlife thief. In an act of desperation to change his behavior, he surrenders the Pegasus boots to us. While we don't love the secondhand shoes, the speed of these babies is too good to pass up, so we take them and throw them on. In parting, the thief tells us that he has already sold the smooth gem to the nearby merchant, and has also spent all the money from the sale. So, if we want the gem, we have to buy it ourselves. The merchant asks a steep 200 rupees to get it, but we need to swim to the House of Gales, so we cough it up.
Irene helps us get back to Zora's domain quickly, and once we return to the Smooth Gem to the Zora Queen's pool, she immediately returns to her normal size and beautiful self. In gratitude for returning her gem, she gives us a pair of Zora flippers, which will impart in us the ability to swim and dive under the water. Glad of the immediate fix to our issue, we head out and test them out in the nearby river. We find some rupees to replenish our wallet, and also a few Mai Mais to return to their mother. But with exploration taking up time, we feel the need to quickly head to the House of Gales and get the third pendant. We reach the island in the middle of the lake, but find it sealed before us. We see the now familiar stone pillars with the symbol of a needed item on them, and head to see our pal Ravio. We find a rod that looks similar to the inscription on the pillars, and Ravio calls it a tornado rod, which will allow us to use a powerful gust of wind to launch us into the air and stun any enemies nearby in the process. We head back to the House of Gales and use it in front of the entrance. Once we do, the gray tiles on the ground are lifted up and off to reveal a switch that we can stand on. We enter the House of Gales and immediately are unable to proceed as the ledge in front of us is too high to pass. We smash some pottery around the room and find another switch, but this one only serves to turn on some fans at the top of the room. With nothing else to try, we use the tornado rod to launch ourselves into the air in front of these wind gusts, and to our delight, we are propelled forward to land on the ledge. This opens up a whole lot of possibilities for us, and we find that the entire dungeon is based more or less around this puzzle mechanic. The rooms are all multi-leveled, and at times gusts of powerful wind block our path. Wall merging is super useful, but since we can only travel sideways, we have to be creative about reaching different heights on the walls so that we can traverse the space entirely. There are also some new enemies here to combat in the form of electrified jellyfish. Keeping these at a safe distance with the bow is the easiest way to deal with them, and we keep progressing upwards through the dungeon, using the many fans to launch us up levels and across gaps in the floor. We come across another new enemy in the form of a skull surrounded by impenetrable flames. The tornado rod snuffs out these flames and briefly stuns the possessed skulls, allowing us to smash them to pieces. The dungeon is full of tricky puzzles to solve in order for us to get the needed keys, but our intellect is up to the challenge, and eventually we find the big key after defeating a pair of flaming heedles. We head further into the dungeon to find the door that the key will open so that we can tackle the boss and claim the third pendant. We find the room and head in to find a platform surrounded on all sides by abyss instead of walls. We jump down onto the platform and immediately a giant wheel with a huge eye in the center drops from the ceiling. This enemy, called Margomil, starts spinning rapidly and projecting compressed air from its spinning body. We can't avoid it as we are too stunned to move at first, but the air cushions the blow without hurting us. However, it is pushing us ever closer to the abyss that surrounds the arena, trying to shove us off the side. We quickly use the tornado rod to launch us over Margomil, and to our pleasant surprise, it stuns the beast, and we land on top of it to hit the eye repeatedly with our sword. Eventually, we're thrown off the beast, and we see it summon more sections of its segmented body to protect itself. We dive back in and slash away at this new protection until we can stun the monster again with our tornado rod and hit its eye once more. After one more round of that, the boss falls, and the dungeon rewards our cleverness and bravery with the Pendant of Wisdom. We head outside the House of Gales, and Sahasrara magically contacts us to give us many kudos. He tells us that with the three pendants of virtue in hand, we have proven ourselves worthy of the Blade of Legend. He tells us to head to the Lost Woods where the blade is hidden deep within those winding pathways. Go now and claim what is rightfully yours. With this powerful charge to lead us, we head for the Lost Woods and for the Blade of Legend and Destiny.
This has been the plot recap as read by Matt. This brings us to part two, which is our takes, where we talk about this section of the game, how it made us feel. So, Jackson, as the guest of the evening, I'm going to pass this around to you first. How did you feel that this section of the game stacked up against the stuff that came before?
So, I think the things that you do leading up to this dungeon are more interesting than in previous dungeons in this game. I think that the Zora stuff is really, really fun. And I just got to say, someone needs to give this smooth stone to Christian Bale to help him on his weight gain and loss for movies, because because that man, when he is large for things like American Hustle, is not the best looking guy. But when he slims down, like for Batman, he is a handsome man. And that's kind of what I was feeling from the from this Zora.
I just want to say that I wish that there existed a stone that I could simply hold in order to keep from bloating.
Yeah, wouldn't that be nice just to have a stone that keeps your weight in check all the time?
I would drink way more beer.
Oh, absolutely. No doubt about that.
Eat way more cheese fries.
Oh, yes.
Yeah.
Oh, that sounds really good.
Yeah. Such a thing, unfortunately, does not exist. I thought the Zora Queen was also a really funny character. This is like a really fun little quirky interaction that happens here. And it's one of those things where I think that we talked about this in the first episode. I'll bring it up again here. This game balances quirky situations pretty well, and it has a pretty charming humor to it. One of those things that, again, I feel works really well in the top-down Zelda games. You know, they have a style, and the toyetic and little miniature person vibes that these games have really plays into that goofy vibe pretty well. So that's fun. I thought this was a nice interaction. But to your point, I think that this is a section of the game that is a lot of fun compared to what we've played before, because this is a part when everything starts to open up a lot, right? Like the gaining of the flippers is always a big moment in Zelda games where they feature as an item, right? In Link's Awakening, Koholint Island opens up a ton once you have the flippers, right? And this game is no exception. The world feels much bigger and much more accessible as soon as you get those. And that's a really fun little transitional period where you can just do a lot more in the overworld than you could before.
And I think that the Link's Awakening tie isn't too far in other aspects, right? Like you were talking about the characters in this game being quirky. It's like they took the idea of the Link's Awakening feel and toned it down by quite a bit, but it still has that quirkiness. Characters have good feel, and they're not just NPCs that stand around like maybe in other games they'll feel that way. But
yeah, well, Link's Awakening is much more surreal than this game.
It is. It's not so much the same in the vibe from people, but just the way that the characters feel more real and have more of those quirky fun moments, and the conversations you have with them can be really just silly in some ways. But one thing that I noticed from this section of game is that in other Zelda games, there is a lot of distinction between every section, right? You know, usually the Tower of Harrow would be all about fire, and this section would be all about water. And the fact that we fight those fire lizards in this section felt a little weird, right? The whole thing is supposed to be around water because it's surrounded by a lake, and it wasn't really that way. It was a lot more wind, but and I thought that was just something that I found interesting. Usually Zelda games have a really good way of distinct feel for each area you go to, and this wasn't quite that.
Well, there's something that Ocarina of Time did to us as Zelda fans, right? Where, especially if that was your introduction to the series, if that was your first big game, which it was for a lot of people, this whole structure where you collect three things and get the Master Sword, right? You just kind of have it in your head that it's like, oh, we're going to do a forest thing, we're going to do a fire thing, and we're going to do a water thing, you know? And I don't mind that it kind of breaks free from that. I think that you sort of have to shake it up a little bit in order to keep things interesting. But it's a good observation, and you're definitely right. It doesn't fit cleanly into those tropes, I guess, that we're used to from the past. How about you, Matt? How are you feeling about this whole section of the game?
Yeah, I was going to say, I don't think that the Zora part was necessarily interesting apart from just the characters. Like, it was basically just a fetch quest, and I've played so many RPGs that fetch quests no longer interest me in any way, shape, or form. But the characters were definitely interesting. I'm looking at the walkthrough right now, and I'm noticing for the first time that when the Zora Queen is all puffed up and bloated, her water is purple, like it is in the ancient cistern. It's like that poison purple water.
So that was kind
of an interesting little note. To Jackson's point about characterization and goofiness, like I felt that it's more Wind Waker-y than the surreal Link's Awakening which I think I talked about in the first episode. But I think I agree with most of the other points. There's definitely a lot more exploration to do, and I did some swimming and got some Mai-Mais, and I'm really glad to have that option for exploration and traversal now.
Did you get the next bottle?
I did not, and I know where it is because it's in the same place it was in A Link to the Past.
Yeah,
but I just didn't go get it because I didn't feel the need to. Mm-hmm. So I'll be doing that at some point eventually. But didn't this time. I did get another full heart container. Found some more pieces of heart.
Cool. So
that
was good. Yeah.
And I'm very glad that I personally had already purchased the tornado rod from Ravio before going to the House of Gales because I didn't have to do any of that backtracking, which kind of leads me back to our discussion about how, you know, you don't get items in dungeons and they've replaced it with a backtracking to Ravio mechanic that I'm starting to like less. Like, I don't think backtracking in a game is normally a good thing. Like, it can be done well, but it's just kind of a point of frustration most of the time for me when I'm like, I've already been there, especially if I've already been there multiple times. Why am I having to go back?
So I'm going to let you finish, Jackson. I think that this is something that you're going to grow to like more once we get into the back half or the back two thirds of the game, because what basically happens is two things take place. Starting next week, we are going to be able to actually permanently purchase items from Ravio. And then once you actually get into the next plane of reality that we go to after this, which we have not been to yet, you can tackle all of those dungeons in any order that you want. And so then this mechanic becomes a little bit more fun because basically you're in this position where you can buy the items permanently and then you can just go off and do some exploring and kind of tackle the dungeons in any order you want based on the items that you have purchased already. So it's like right now it's a little gated, right? Where it's like, do these dungeons one at a time. Go back to Ravio, get the item, then go back to the dungeon. And that does kind of continue a little bit, but it just feels a bit more open after this than it has up until now. It doesn't feel quite as restrictive.
Well, and I can tell you, Matt, from experience, when you embarrassingly die and have to go back and repurchase all of them again.
Oh, no. Did you die, Jackson?
Not in the House of Gales. I was left with like half a heart and I didn't have any potions or heart pieces on me to restore. And it's just annoying when you just get shot by an arrow or a bird attacks you from behind and you just didn't see it. And then you die and then you have to go back and repurchase all of them. But the worst part is when you die, instead of saying game over, Ravi speaks to you and goes, ha, I'm going to take all that back now. Thanks very much.
Classic Ravio move. Yeah.
What a douche. So I don't know. I hope you're right that I think owning an item is definitely going to be a big step forward. I don't know. That's just kind of where I landed with it. Didn't do a ton of outside exploration outside of what was needed, but definitely looking forward to doing more of that in the next couple of weeks. Probably not next week because I imagine it's going to be a pretty chunky section. And then once we open up both Hyrule and Lowrule, we'll be able to, you know, spend some more time in
Lowrule,
both places.
What's that?
We've already talked about it in the first episode. There's definitely a lot that I want to look around and do and explore and, get my hands on, as it were. So I'm looking forward to doing more of that as the world opens up.
Well, and before you get into the dungeon, I've just got to say, for as much grief as I gave Asphala for being a buffoon, the Zora underlings are pretty dumb. They're very clueless and useless. Yeah, and useless is a good term. They're all like, especially when you're looking at the queen, they're all like, we don't know what to do. We're really freaking out. And then the guy that's telling you how to get to Zoro's domain is just like, I'm a Zora. I have no idea. Some dude just jumped the bridge. I don't know.
Also, he can't swim, which doesn't make any sense. Azora that can't swim, that doesn't track for me, but
poor guy.
There you go.
Yeah. Yeah. So let's talk real quick. So we've already mentioned the main item for this week, and as it's not a dungeon item, that means we're talking about it in this section. So the wind rod is
tornado rod.
Oh, sorry, tornado rod. Definitely an interesting one. How long did it take y'all to figure out that you could flip those tiles with it?
I pretty much knew immediately. I just stood in the middle of the pillars and activated it because I figured that's what you're supposed to do.
The only part of the tornado rod that I had trouble with was the fact that you can only go up. You can't then float forwards and backwards with it like you could with other things in other Zelda games when you're hovering, right?
Mm-hmm.
And I found that to be extremely annoying because instinctively I wanted to use it that way. And there was a couple times in the dungeon where there's that roller that you have to hover over. And I hovered too early and then would land on the roller again.
Mm-hmm.
And I was, it was just a pain.
Yeah. It's not nearly as useful as the Korok leaf.
Yeah,
from Wind Waker.
And that's one of those things where experience with past Zelda games has kind of conditioned you to think of this as a traversal tool more than it really is. What the tornado rod really is a stun tool. And it is useful in that context. I mean, it's got a pretty big area of effect. Mm-hmm. So if you're getting mobbed by a bunch of dudes, then it is useful in that way. When you upgrade it, it's even better. So yeah, I mean, it's a nifty little item. It doesn't have quite the same I guess moment to moment fun factor is the bow or even the fire rod, which I know.
I don't have it yet.
Oh, you don't?
No, I didn't get the fire or ice rods yet.
Okay, cool. But it is still a nifty little thing. From a pure puzzle solving standpoint, it is kind of a one trick pony. And that's okay. That's fine. You know, not every single item in a Zelda game can be the best. Like,
yeah, you know? I did find I enjoyed it for puzzle solving more than as a combat tool. The part that I actually had more trouble with than the roller was timing the part where you've got the platform that's moving back and forth and you have to go up and then land on it. And even more than that was the entrance to the boss room where you have to stand on the very edge of the moving tile, go up and then land on the front one.
Yeah.
That one I fell off like two or three times before I got it right. So
yep.
Well, luckily I got those the first try just by luck. I'm not necessarily bragging, but I'm not not bragging.
No, we're very proud of you, Jackson. But again, that's another feather in the cap of your platforming argument, right? Mm-hmm. Like that was a big component of puzzle solving with the tornado rod. But we're skirting around dungeon talk right now. So does anybody else have anything that they want to say about this section of the game generally before we get to talking about the House of Gales? This brings us to part three, which is the dungeon map, where we talk about this week's dungeon from mechanics to music and more. The dungeon this week is the House of Gales, notable for being the first dungeon that we've played in this game that is not a reprise of a previous dungeon.
I was about to say, this is a unique dungeon.
Yeah. Actually, this little island that it's set on was it was home to just...
That was the Ice Palace, wasn't it?
No.
Well, in the dark world, it would have been the Ice Palace. Yeah.
So there's just a little cave there on Lake Hylia in A Link to the Past, and in the intervening 100 years, it has become a pretty impressive looking windmill structure. So definitely got a big theme to it, notable for being a much better wind dungeon than the Wind Temple in the Wind Waker.
Yep, that tracks.
the Wind Temple had its like one big fan, right? And this one's got a bunch of fans.
It does have a lot of fans. It definitely redeemed the Wind Temple.
Poor Wind Temple.
It's just not a good dungeon.
Yeah, it's not. It's not great. It's not great. Look, I really enjoyed this one quite a lot.
Did you really feel like an airbender in this one? Is that why?
A little bit, actually. A little bit. What this one loses in sheer size versus the Tower of Hera, it gains in having much more of... So last week I was talking about the difference between highly vertical dungeons and then slightly more sprawling dungeons.
Yes.
And this one definitely falls into a bit of the ladder camp, right? Where it's three main floors... And the floors are each pretty spread out. There's several major rooms between all the floors that you have to do some puzzle solving in. And, again, like I said last week, it's not that I think one of those is better than the other inherently. They're just different approaches to dungeon design.
Yeah.
And so it was nice going back to this type after having done a very vertical dungeon last week.
Well, and I noticed I got lost or went in circles a lot more in this one than the Tower of Hera. The Tower of Hera, I didn't have such a hard time figuring out how to advance, but there was a few times in this one where you get turned around a little bit and you just kind of get stuck going through the same doors to the same places when you're like trying to figure out the puzzle. And so I thought that was a bit interesting. You can really get turned around in this.
I definitely found myself referencing my map much more in this dungeon than I did in the Tower of Hera. Like Tower of Hera, you definitely like you knew where you had to get to. It was just like, how do I make it through this room to get to the next floor, right? Mm-hmm. And this dungeon, it was much more exploratory, I think, which is definitely fun. The fans are a fun mechanic. I think there was a nice level of complexity in the fans as puzzles, where especially the rooms that had like several different fans that you had to activate in a certain sequence. Otherwise, you would get just blown back to the beginning of the room. You know, that's fun. There's thought required in those. There's like an analysis that you have to do of the room once you realize that you have to do things in a specific order. And that's nice. That's a pretty classic top-down Zelda brain teaser.
Well, and I thought it was a big surprise when you walk into one of the rooms where all the fans are pre-activated and you walk in front of the fan and you get blown in like a square. And then Link just kind of sits on his butt.
Yeah.
And you kind of sit there going, what just happened? And then you have to realize.
Exit the room and yes, go back in. And
yeah. Exactly. And I thought that was a really interesting way of like, I like that it was a little bit of a surprise. Like you weren't really expecting those to be on because in other rooms they're not. So I thought that was fun and different and interesting.
They created like a maze of your own design, right? Where you have to activate certain switches, but not other ones, or else you'll either fall off and die or not die, but get hurt. In Lyndon's case, you might die.
I did not die in this dungeon.
Well, that's good. So yeah, I thought that was a good use of the room. While I agree that it's definitely not like the most vertical dungeon, especially that we've had recently, there is a lot of verticality, just mostly on the same floor, just going up and down,
right? Yeah.
You know, half levels, quarter level, three quarter level, whatever. Right. Mm-hmm. So, I felt like that was a really huge part of what made this dungeon challenging from a puzzle and traversal perspective. And I thought it was implemented very well. Like I said, in the plot recap, the wall merging combined with the, height differential was definitely challenging and kind of pushed me to think about how to position myself, especially like between rooms, because the center room, you know, you have various places you can go, but then you go to either the side rooms and you can maybe get to another half level and then go in on a different part of the center room and move around. And it keeps you thinking about how do I get from where I am to that point in the corner over there where I know I need to be. And then you go through all the steps of, I can't do it in this room, so maybe I need to go to the next room. And then in the next room, you figure out, okay, that door on the far wall over there looks like it leads up, but I can't get there because there's a fan turned on. So I need to figure out how to turn that fan off or go around the fan. So it was a lot of very spatial orientation type of puzzle solving, which is sometimes annoying, but in this case was not. And was executed well, I think.
Yeah. And sometimes it's fun because sometimes there's a little bit of trial and error that's required when you're trying to figure out how to get on a level via wall traversal in order to get to a thing, right? Yep. Like you'll merge into the wall and you'll start scooting over in the direction you know you need to be, but then you'll realize that you're like a level lower than you need to be. So then you've got to pop off and then try to tackle it from another way and see like, okay, how do I get up to the necessary height so that I can solve this puzzle?
Yeah. And another great way of showing that this is not all about verticality is the amount of time that you spend outside, I thought was really fun. The times that you spend on the exterior of the tower was really interesting.
Yeah.
But also the blocks, the moving blocks and having to merge into the blocks as they move and switch sides and then jump out on the right side to make sure you don't fall into the crevices is I thought a really great puzzle and something that was different from just merging into a wall that you normally would. It's something moving and three-dimensional. You have to go on to different sides.
So I'm not sure if it was the same for y'all, but for me, I found myself having to be much more cognizant of my stamina meter in this dungeon.
Yeah, I almost fell off a couple of times. And it's definitely it definitely was more of a management than it has been recently.
Yeah. One thing that I found was I fell two times because I was exploring, seeing if merging into a wall and going all the way to the other side of a room, maybe there was something over there that I couldn't see and I just didn't have enough stamina to make it back. And as much as you watch your stamina meter in this dungeon, I still found that getting the stamina from pots was basically useless.
Yeah, I do. I think that's one area of criticism that I still have for this mechanic. And I'm struggling to remember if it becomes more of a concern as puzzles get more complex later in the game. But I definitely do wish right now that there were some puzzles that require you to really push the limits of your stamina bar a bit more, right? With some purple pots to refill between some of those longer wall traversal puzzles. I think right now, you know, they're scattered around and you pick one up. And I think I generally always was mostly full on stamina whenever I would find one.
Yeah, I wish you could hold on to them. Maybe set a max of two. You can only hold two or one at a time rather than just being able, like a heart where you walk over them. And then if you have full hearts, they just disappear. Right. I think if you got to hold on to them, then you could really do what you're talking about and make stamina and those long, like, where you almost run out, pop the stamina thing, keep going. And if you don't have a stamina on you, then you're screwed.
Go find one.
Yeah exactly.
It becomes another puzzle mechanic instead of just a world pickup.
Yeah, like you could have a potion for that, but if you don't have any potions on you, there are ones that only increase your stamina by 25% or half instead of all the way up like a potion might.
Important. I definitely agree with you, Jackson. I think one of the ongoing things we like to do on this show is to theorize ways that this could be even more difficult, right?
How do we make this harder?
Yeah, exactly.
Other than hero mode where people are just more difficult to kill, right? How are the puzzles possibly more interesting?
Well, actually, they're not. So I am playing this one in hero mode, and the enemies are not more difficult to kill. They just do four times damage to you. So, yeah, they're pretty dangerous. But, yeah, I mean, yeah, adding an extra level of resource management is always one of those fun, like, ah, this would make it harder. I think that's always a good one to fall back on. But, yeah, so I completely agree with all of that. I'll touch back on that later as we go further into this game and kind of see, like, oh, hey, this puzzle is exactly what we were talking about back in House of Gales, right? We'll see where we land with that. How long did it take you guys to figure out that you can put the fires out with the tornado rod?
Instantly.
Yeah, I didn't have any trouble with that one.
Yeah, me neither. But I agree with you, Jackson. The areas where you do go out onto the exterior of the building are pretty fun. We got a fun little mini boss fight in this dungeon.
I was going to say it was our first mini boss of the series so far. The two Heedles. Heedles, yeah.
Is that what they're called?
Mm-hmm. Okay. According to our friend Cody Davies.
Because they're hot beetles?
I guess so. Yeah, sure, that works for me. According to Cody Davies' guide, which you can find on Zelda Universe, he has a guide for A Link Between Worlds, so you can go read that if you're stuck.
Hey, Jackson, Josh on Discord has a question for you. He says, my question for your brother is, why did you skip playing Zelda 2 when it would have changed your life forever?
I don't really have a reason. I just
didn't want to.
Well,
which I don't blame you for.
I mean, yeah, of all the games to not play, I guess that's a good one to not.
I think most people would agree with you on that.
Somewhere Josh just shed one single solitary tear.
And I'm very sorry.
There you go. You heard Josh's feelings. Hope you're happy with yourself.
I think we do that regularly on this podcast, honestly.
Josh gets a lot of crap. Poor guy. He'll be on to defend his position next week.
Awesome.
Yeah, I know. It's going to be great. He's got a big, big chunk of game to talk about next week. No, the Heedle mini boss fight was a good time, specifically on hero mode. Those guys do a lot of damage. They take a lot of damage. Like, it takes quite a few hits to really down them. And then in addition to that, they leave that damaging fire path in their wake that you have to kind of manage as well. So, yeah, I actually found this to be a very fun little boss fight. I could have even had one more in that room.
I think so, too, because I guess maybe I just got lucky. I killed them both pretty quickly. I got lucky enough to stun them both. I basically stun locked them because they were both close enough that I hit them with my first tornado rod swing.
Yeah.
And then they just kind of, yeah, I just did a spin attack and then did it again and stunned them again. And like I killed them very fast, but I kind of wish I hadn't, so that I would have had an opportunity to like sit in the fight a little bit longer and explore some of those mechanics. But yeah, I think I just got lucky.
Well, I think something that is fun that I did in this mini boss fight that I definitely did a lot more in the final boss fight was item switching between the tornado rod and the bow, which
did that a lot in the boss fight.
Yes, a lot in the boss
fight.
Wait,
do you have two item spots or are you using one?
No, only have one. I only have one. So you have to pause and switch.
You got to go get that other one, man.
Yeah, so I had to pause and switch, which wasn't actually that big of a hassle considering that unlike something like Destiny, you can actually pause this game. So I'm not having played Destiny so much, I'm not used to the creature comforts of pause.
And the invulnerability that it gives you.
Yes, exactly.
Yeah. Oh man, that's funny. Yeah, no, you got to get that second item slot. It is truly a game changer. And there actually is, I think later in the game, Ravio informs you of a way that you can more quickly swap items without having to go straight into the pause screen. So,
ooh, fun.
So that's fun. That's a thing that's coming up. But yeah, I mean, do we want to say anything else about the puzzle mechanics of this dungeon before we go and we talk about the boss?
Yeah, I think that I enjoyed the puzzle mechanics more in Tower of Hera than in this one. Not that these were bad, but I just think that Tower of Hera felt more rewarding to get the puzzles right. Not because that they were any easier, but more of just I had more fun with the springs than with the fans. Personal preference, I think that the fans added more challenge perhaps, but I found them to be a little frustrating at times. Well, I like the springs.
The springs in Tower of Hera have much more of a requirement for precision, I think.
Yeah, I like that you had to be directional with them, and the fans weren't that. I like that added, as you say, precision of having to face the right direction to get sprung in the right place. Personal preference, but yeah, no, I thought it was fun, but Tower of Hera, I think, did a better job personally.
Well, there you go. I think I agree, actually. I think I'm right there with you. Matt?
Yeah, I'm having a hard time deciding which one I liked more, but I think both were well done and well executed. So far, I think these are the best three intro dungeons in a top-down Zelda game. Like, just a solid overall. None of them were overly difficult. None of them were ridiculously easy. And I think that so far...
Even Eastern Palace was.
Yeah, yeah. I think that this is a very good execution of intro dungeons on a top-down Zelda game. And all three are very solid in that way.
Yeah. Well, and that's one of those things where even in, you know, Link's Awakening, my darling, you know, Tail Cave is a pushover, right?
Yeah, I mean, like... That's one of the reasons why it's our favorite introductory to the series game, right. Is it's not going to turn anybody off out of difficulty.
Yeah.
Well, and I would love these kinds of puzzles to be incorporated with the ways that you use items in a Link's Awakening, specifically, you know, being able to jump and the dashing and things like that. I like the movement better in A Link's Awakening, but I like the puzzles better here. So I would love to see a mashup of this kind of a puzzle and this kind of a verticality with Link's Awakening movement and items.
One thing that the dungeons in this game, one major way that they're different from Link's Awakening is that in A Link's Awakening, one thing we talked about a lot was the fact that the dungeons were a bit of a key fest,
mm-hmm.
right?
Yeah.
And
just so many keys.
Yes. And that's much less of a going concern here. Like, it's still a thing, you know.
This had more keys than the other two dungeons combined.
Yeah.
Yeah. But I still was very shocked at how fast I got the boss key. Like, I found it and still had like a couple rooms to go through before I reached the boss room. So when I actually like opened, I saw the big chest pop up. I was like, oh, I'm kind of shocked that that's happening so fast. it was a little strange, but yeah.
I kind of like that better though. There's this thing that gets me a little irrationally annoyed. I couldn't tell you why, but I hate it when dungeons give you the boss key immediately before the boss room. Like Tower of Hera last week, you get to that top floor
and get the boss key, and then you like are immediately
there. It's like immediately there. Yeah. I don't know why that is, but
it's interesting because I'm thinking back to Ocarina of Time and Skyward Sword, and that almost never happened. Like, you would normally get the boss key with still like a quarter of the dungeon to go, right?
Well, and there was, and especially in Ocarina of Time, there's generally a much more dedicated section of the dungeon that revolves around the getting of the boss key, right?
Right.
Like you kind of have to, you know, like there's a whole section of the dungeon you have to get to get the main item, right? And then there's another similar section of dungeon that you then have to go to get the boss key.
Right.
I think it's the mini bosses. I think that's what I think.
But it's not, because normally the mini bosses will give you the dungeon item. So I think that's what is causing this phenomenon, is the lack of dungeon items means that there's not really a purpose outside of the boss key for mini bosses or for like the really intense puzzles, right? Because in most other games where you have dungeon items, you go through either an intense puzzle with the items you have, or you go through a boss fight, a mini boss fight, to get the dungeon item. And then that leads into another series of puzzles that will lead you to the boss key that you then have to use the dungeon item to, you know, maneuver around the part of the dungeon you couldn't get to. And none of that exists here because there is no dungeon item. So I'm starting to solidify my position that we kind of posited at the beginning of lack of dungeon items is not necessarily a good thing. And I'm not saying it's a bad thing yet, but I don't think it's helping.
The thing is, the dungeons are fun from front to back, but they don't have the sense of like a tier structure,
right,
that they do in other Zelda games.
Exactly.
Right.
Even though they're floors, which are literal tiers.
Right. Well, yes, there is that. But like in past Zelda games, there are ways in which the dungeon opens up a lot once you get that main item. Right.
Well, I agree with what Matt said, but I actually think that's why, to my point, Lyndon likes this one more, is because the mini boss, which is the first one, as you say, we've gotten in this game, is a way to maintain or is a way to obtain the boss key while still having some things left to do in the dungeon, which is why I think you don't have such a frustration with this one, right? The fact that we get a mini boss 2/3 of the way through allows us to have an interesting way to maintain or to obtain the boss key. And still have things to go.
You don't get the boss key from the mini bosses, though.
No, you get it from the next room that has a bunch of the anti-fairies that you have to kill with the tornado rod.
No, you get it on the outside of the building. You pull a switch after putting out some fires.
Oh
yeah.
That's why.
Oh, yeah.
That's why now that you say that, that's why I was so surprised that I got the boss key, because I felt like that was a weird time to get it. It felt too early. Another reason why I was shocked to have the mini boss fight, because I was a little taken aback that, one, we hadn't had one yet, and two, that there was this one, and three, there wasn't a actual reward from killing them except for progressing.
So the one thing that mini boss fights do in this game, which is similar to Link's Awakening, is that they function as a sort of halfway point to the dungeon where you activate that portal and you can go freely from the entrance to a later point in the dungeon.
Just in case you die, you don't have to do the whole thing
all
over again.
Earlier dungeons had that too. It wasn't specifically a mini boss fight in the first two dungeons. It was more of like a room full of enemies, yeah. You know? But so there is that. I mean, I appreciate that in theory. I don't find myself really needing to use those portals ever. Well, actually, I say that. I did.
I was about to say, you used it last week.
Never mind. My point is immediately refuted.
Your point is moot.
I admit the futility of my point.
Yeah, I don't know. I guess is it the pacing of the dungeon we're talking about, I guess?
Yeah, I think so.
Yeah. Like,
the way these dungeons feel is, instead of having dungeons which are structured in three acts, mm-hmm. basically.
Yeah, it's just one.
It's just one, and it's consistently good all the way through, but you don't have quite as much of a feeling of momentum, I guess, is the way that I would put it, mm-hmm. you know?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, like a sense of place. Like, you don't necessarily know when you're... You don't feel it when you're getting close to the end. It feels the same as the rest of the dungeon.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. You don't. It doesn't ground you in, I'm coming to the end. I need to, like, gear myself up for the boss fight, I guess. Yeah. Huh. We'll leave it that, I guess.
Yeah. All right. Well, let's go ahead and talk about the boss of this dungeon. Do we have a name for this thing?
Yes. It was more. Where'd it go? Hold on. I have it written down. Thanks again, Cody Davies. Margomill. Margomill.
This is an interesting one, right?
It kind of reminded me of the, was it the Dig Dug?
The Dig Dogger.
The Dig Dogger. It yeah. reminded me of the Dig Dogger.
Yeah.
Because it's just the giant circle with the eye in the middle.
You know yeah. what I thought of?
What?
I thought of the, like, cactus sand things in Mario that you have to knock the bits off to get to the head to kill it.
Oh, I guess I can kind of see that.
Yeah, like well, especially yeah. with the segmented body as it gets taller. Yeah, yeah
exactly.
Yeah,
I see that. Exactly.
Yeah. So I will say that I thought that this was a fun boss fight. I liked that the boss... So three phases, obviously, right?
As they all do. And, of course, hit the eyeball, as right. yep. most of them do.
I do like that the boss gets beefier as you go through the three phases, mm. right?
Yep.
That's fun. I really could have done with an extra layer of difficulty in here. Like, this boss does not do a lot of damage to you if you're good at moving around
right. space. Because he doesn't hurt you if he hits you. And even when he hits you, it's not like a stun lock to push you off. You can still get out of it.
Yeah.
So I do think that it was a not necessarily challenging boss for that reason. I maybe would have liked some another layer of environmental hazard, maybe like some of those rolling pins that you hate so much, Jackson. I think that would have been interesting.
Well, even if the boss had like, imagine if there are four spikes coming off of the base of uh-huh. the boss and they change. Mm-hmm. Right. So it's like,
oh, yeah,
they go north, south, east and west, and then they go. Northeast, southeast, southwest.
You know, yeah. Or what if he like started spitting out fireballs every once in a while and start throwing fire at you?
It just turns into Mothula.
Never mind. Yeah, screw that. No, we don't like that one.
I did have one slightly annoying thing happen in this boss fight, which was he hit me, which pushed me into the bottom right corner. So then, of course, my only way out is to go up, and then he immediately tracked me and pushed me off the edge.
Ah, yeah.
I mean, it's got a, you know, that is the main hazard of this boss.
But even then, on normal mode, that only takes half a heart.
That's the thing.
That's the thing, is it takes half a heart away when you fall.
And even on hero mode, that's true. On hero mode...
Really, it's only half a heart for fall damage.
You don't take extra damage from falling.
I was curious about that, because I was going to say, like, if you fall off, and here, so this is now purely hypothetical, now that I know this isn't true, but, like, this boss could be very difficult in hero mode if the fall damage was quadrupled like everything else, because, two hearts is big, especially this early in the game when you maybe have six or maybe seven.
Yeah. Well, and I wish that maybe the arena was surrounded by like spike traps or something that actually do more damage, because then it would have had a bit more urgency associated with it.
Yeah,
you know, that's fair. Like I said, I think that it's fun. It was a good time, but I really wish it would have pushed me just a little bit more. Like,
again, theory crafting how we could make something harder. I bet a lot of people love that.
Yeah,
this boss I think was easier than. Our first boss.
Well, it was easier than Moldorm too.
Yeah. I think that the first boss would be harder if you weren't able to stun him out of doing every single attack.
You mean Yuga?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. Cause if you can stun him out of every single attack,
yeah.
but
yeah.
if you couldn't stun him, that would be a harder boss fight. But because you can stun him out of shooting lightning or whatever, this became the easiest boss so far.
Yeah. I didn't take any damage on Yuga. So I think Just going back to your point, Jackson, about item switching and, you know, utilizing heavily multiple items for this fight, or you were talking about it for the Heedles. I used the bow almost exclusively to damage his segments. Like, I would kind of get a safe distance away from him and just plink away at him whenever his air force went away. And then that's really how I made this boss a lot easier for myself, is instead of trying to get up close and hit his stuff away, which then puts you in more danger of getting pushed off of a ledge, just kind of stand a little ways away, shoot him with a bow a couple of times. That does add a magic meter maintaining or maintenance part of the fight, which again is a can be an interesting thing to do. So that's kind of how I went about tackling this fight. How did you do it, Jackson?
I did it exactly the same way. And basically, I waited till he went into a corner, moved closer to the middle, and then I would just shoot him with arrows. And then when my magic meter ran out, you just kind of evade until you get your magic meter back. And then you go again, and then you leave a little bit in order to fly up and then hit his eyeball.
A classic airbender tactic. Avoid and evade.
Yes, exactly. This is Airbender the Dungeon.
Pretty much.
It really is, yes.
Yeah. So, there you go. I mean, I think overall, a fun boss fight. Had a good time with it. Could have been harder.
Agreed.
Cool. All right, well, let's go ahead and, assuming nobody else has anything else to say about the dungeon, get into part four, which is Bloopy Trails, where we talk about interesting things that diverted our attention this week.
Last thing I will say about dungeons in general, actually, is I appreciate how many rupees they give you in every dungeon. Like, there was a lot of rupees to be had in this dungeon, and I appreciate that, as I now have like over 2,000.
Well, and you'll need them, because buying the items from Ravio is,
I assume, is going to be crazy expensive.
It's expensive, yeah.
Yeah, yeah, this is by far the most inflated that rupees have ever been in Zelda. They are overflowing and abundant. I mean, before the first dungeon, you're hitting 500.
Yeah. And I find it interesting that there are no wallet upgrades. Like, it's just out of the gate, you can hold an infinite amount of rupees, which I think is interesting.
Yeah. Yep.
All right, I'm done. Now we can move on to Bloopy Trails.
Can we go to Bloopy Trails now?
Yes, we can go to Bloopy Trails now.
Thank you. I'll go ahead and go first. I mean, a lot of what I was doing this week was doing my collecting, mm-hmm. Which is kind of like, don't need to be doing it right now because they're technically useless to you.
I was about to say, you can't do anything with them until you own the items.
Right, exactly. But, you know, like I said before, I have the flippers now, and it's one of those things where moving from Zora's Domain back down to Lake Hylia, now I'm like listening and hearing the little squeaks, I'm like, ooh, I'm going to go find a Mai real quick, you know?
Yep.
It's just one of those fun things. It works kind of the same way as Korok seed puzzles do, right? Where it's like, yes, I'm going to do a thing, but oh, hey, that circle of stones has a gap in it. I'm going to take care of that real quick.
You know? Yeah. Did you find the Mai next to the House of Gales under the...
Yeah, I did. Jackson, have you visited Mother Mai yet?
Yeah, I did. Okay. So as soon as I was able, I went and got the bombs and opened that up and started that.
Okay, cool. So yeah, definitely did that. I got that second bottle, which, you know, bottles are always a great thing to have. But that's mostly what I got up to this week. I wanted to go into the House of Gales with another heart container. So I went in there with six, which was a big help.
I went in with seven. Do you fill your bottles with potion or with magic milk, quote unquote?
Well, I fill them with fairies.
Okay, well, that's better than both. Yeah, fair enough.
So, yeah. But yeah, I mean, that's basically all that there was for me. I haven't done too many of the mini games yet. I'm planning on going and doing the Cuckoo run next week and having some fun with that, because that can be kind of a challenging one, you know? That's a mini game you could spend some time on.
Yep. So I did a little bit of my collecting. I obviously have seven heart containers. I found my first Great Fairy Fountain, so that was kind of neat, over by the Eastern Palace, entrance to Eastern Palace, I guess. and then I did the Cuckoo game and I beat it all the way. I beat all of the tiers of the Cuckoo game, much to Jackson's dismay, as he was sitting right next to me after having just complained about failing it on what, chick? Or was it the
first one?
The chicken? Yeah, the chick. You failed the chick level like two or three times. And you're like, this is so hard. And then I went and beat it, and I only failed on Rooster once. And I think everything else I did in one try. So you were very dismayed, but I thought it was fun. I enjoyed that a lot. So I liked that game. I did the Rupee Rush. I found the Rupee Rush gal. Did that one. Broke Even, because that one's kind of weird. I don't really know the pattern of it well enough to like.
Well, that one is also hard to do really well at until you've got. But I guess you have a lot of the items in your inventory already.
I do, but I like I said, I wasn't really sure the best path to be successful there. So I'll probably go revisit it just for fun. Obviously, I don't need the rupees, but it's just a fun thing to do. So I'll probably go do that one again. I ended it with like 1.17 seconds left, which I was pretty proud of, that my ability to keep time was accurate like that. So
yeah,
other than that, I think that was pretty much all I did.
Okay, cool. How about you, Jackson?
Yeah, I didn't really do a whole lot, mainly because I went from the start of the game all the way through the House of Gales in one day, basically. So, yeah, I really didn't do a whole lot of adventuring. I didn't really find that there was a whole lot of adventuring to do. You kind of just find things as they come to you, and then you do them, which I don't really have a problem with. I think that this is one of those games that you can... This is one of those Zelda games that you can just like load in and just play and not really have to think about going off and doing extra things. And yeah, exactly. Just go do the story.
Cool. All right. Well, let's move on to part five, which is Z targeting, where we lock on to fascinating characters or enemies that we happen to cross. This is going to be, look, who's taking the Zora Queen?
Yeah, I'm taking Christina Bale, the Zora Queen.
Christina Bale.
canon. I love it.
It's a good one.
It's great.
Nux on that one.
Well done. Put that one in the win column, Jackson. Yeah, I mean, okay, cool. Feel free to wax poetic about Christina Bale for a minute if you feel the need to do so.
If you don't, you don't have to.
No, I mean, I went into detail about it earlier when we were going over this section of the game. So, but quite the interesting character. Mm-hmm. I'm not sure. Other times you do Zora stuff in other Zelda games, they're more of like a regal race that is high and mighty. And this time they're a bit goofy, which I think is interesting.
It's one of those funny things where Zoras have just become so much more of a thing since their early appearances, where they were just monsters shooting fireballs at you from lakes, yep. You know? And so because of that, you know, they've got to honor that incarnation of the Zoras in this game, since it's a sequel to A Link to the Past. But it does create this weird sort of thing where it's like, man, these versions of Zoras really have basically nothing in common with
any of the other Zoras.
Yeah, with the ones that we've come to know since they were originally introduced.
I mean, it's funny when you look at it's hard to not compare to Ocarina of Time, but I will again. But Zoras and Ocarina of Time are very slender and regal and sleek, and in this one all of the Zora underlings are a bit chub. They're
they're all kind of Creature from the Black Lagoon-y.
I was gonna say they look more like the mermans from various horror movies, right?
Yeah, they're definitely different, and I appreciate that. I'm glad that it's breaking the mold. I thought it was refreshing and fun.
I guess this also kind of puts a pin in the whole conversation we had back in The Legend of Zelda, which was, is it Zola or Zora, right?
Yeah, because these are the same more or less character sprites of the Zoras from Legend of Zelda and A Link to the Past. Mm-hmm. And I don't know if they were in Adventure of Link or Link's Awakening. I don't think they were in either of those games.
They were in Link's Awakening.
Oh, well, then it's the same character model and sprite as those three games.
Yeah.
So to your point about when they were first introduced, technically these are exactly the same as when they were first introduced. Yeah. But, you know, anyway, they're definitely interesting.
So I'm going to go ahead and pick the Zora who can't swim.
Damn it.
Sorry, Matt.
That was my second.
I love doing that. I love doing that to you.
That was my second choice as well.
No, I have questions about this guy. Where does he live? Does he just have a house?
And does that mean that Zoras don't require to be in water? Like, I know that they can walk around on land. They can do that in any game. But most of the time, they, like, live near water and generally spend most of their time in water, I assume for some biological reason. Like, not unlike Namor from Wakanda Forever. Right. If you keep him out of water, he loses his powers. I would assume Zoras would be similar to that in some way. But this guy, I guess, doesn't? Or maybe he just sticks to the shallows, where he can walk around and like flounder.
I think this Zora was adopted by a Hylian family and has lived his whole life on the land.
That probably sucks for him.
I know. It's got to be very frustrating. Someone should really teach this Zora how to swim.
Yeah, for sure.
I'm sure if he was on a farm somewhere, the farmer might often find him laying in the water trough for the cows.
In a shallow pool somewhere.
he's in the drinking well sometimes. You're just like, get out of there. We drink from that water.
Yes, exactly.
Off in Lon Lon Ranch. There you go. He was
adopted by Talon from Lon Lon Ranch.
Yes. Yeah. There you go. Well, Matt, I think I sent you scrambling for your Z targeting picks.
Well, I guess I'll go with the shady guy who gives you the Pegasus boots he wants to give up his life of crime, and apparently the only way to do that is to give up these super powerful magical boots. So I appreciate the free super powerful magical boots.
I love his unflinching honesty about himself, right?
Yeah, he's like, I just couldn't overcome the temptation to steal everything that isn't nailed down because I know I can get away with it. Huh, that's like, all right.
Man, I think you should talk to someone about that.
Also, for being such a shady guy, he didn't even charge you. Like,
sure.
Seems a bit out of character, but hey, you know what? Anybody can become anything that they want to be.
I was going
to
say, in some ways, this guy has a bit more of a moral compass than Ravio.
Ravio's just like sleazy, in my opinion. He's complicated.
Also, what is Ravio? Like, what is
You'll
his...
find out.
He's a dude in a bunny suit.
Yeah. He's a dude. He's just a dude.
Yeah. That's an outfit. He's not a critter.
All right. So there you go. There's our Z targeting picks.
Well, with all that being said, there's my classic segue right there.
Indeed.
Mm-hmm. Let's move into part six, which is our final thoughts, in which we let Matt wrap up this section of the game in as succinct a way as he can think to do.
Well,
you knew this was coming.
I know. I knew it was. It comes every week, and sometimes it still catches me because it's always off the cuff. I never pre-prepare anything, so sometimes it just takes me a little longer to get the creative juices flowing. So just one second. So we start this section of game looking for our third pendant so that we can prove our worthiness to be the wielder of the Sword of Destiny, which leads us on a fetch quest through a large portion of the Land of Hyrule to help the Zora people and their queen. We get some powerful boots from a shady guy who really needs to talk to a counselor about impulse control. We get the gem back and through that obtain the Zora flippers so that we can traverse the waterways of Hyrule and go into the House of Gales, where we are challenged by a dungeon that pushes the limits of our puzzle solving abilities and problem solving, introduces some new enemies and some fun mechanics, culminating this dungeon in a decent but not overly challenging boss fight. And we end this section of game with our path firmly set before us by the wonderful Sahasrara to lead into the Lost Woods to find the Master Sword and continue on our way to save the princess and Hyrule from the evil clutches of Yuga and Ganon.
Those were three very long run-on sentences.
You said Ganon. Has Ganon even been mentioned in this game so far?
Yeah, Sahasrara says Yuga is obviously trying to resurrect Ganon because he's capturing descendants of the sages.
Gotcha. Okay, cool. Just making sure. All right, well, that brings us to the end of the Sacred Realms rundown. We will, of course, be back next week with another installment talking about another far beefier section of the game. A lot going on next week. It's going to be a big old episode. Jackson, been a really fun time having you on, man.
It's been great to be back.
So can we expect you to pop into these a little bit more frequently than you have done over the past 2.5 years?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, most of the time I wait for an invite. I'm not going to invite myself over as much as you tell me that I can, but will not.
Well, the good news is that a lot of the games that we now have upcoming are going to be playable to you in a much more accessible way on the Switch. So Minish Cap, the Oracles, you know, we've got a lot of the upcoming games that are going to be easy to play much more so than they were even a few months ago. So.
Well, and I will say, thank goodness for returning to the Switch, because I don't have a 3DS XL. I just have a normal 3DS, and my large hands have a very hard time playing extended periods of time on.
I have kind of dainty hands, and even on the 3DS XL, my hands are getting a little sore playing this game. It's still fun. It's not putting me out in any major way, but yeah, I definitely prefer the form factor of the Switch to this. So yeah, but you know, what are you going to do? This is what we have. So cool. Well, until that glorious day when you return to us, Jackson, been a really great time. Glad we could get you back around for another one of these episodes. It has truly been way too long. Maybe we'll be able to have you back on for another 3D episode of something at some point, because I think you've been on sort of a run of 2Ds for a while here.
Yeah, I was on Ocarina, then Link's Awakening, and then A Link to the Past, and now this.
Not Skyward, though, right?
Not Skyward.
Okay, cool. Have you played Skyward Sword HD?
Yeah, I played a little bit. I didn't get to finish it, though. But I did start it on the Switch.
Got to bounce back to that and finish it out. It's a really good one. It's very fun. Very fun time. Well, are y'all ready to get out of here for the week? Close this one out?
Let's do it.
All right, y'all. If you enjoyed today's show and you would like a little extra Sacred Realms in your life, you can head over to patreon.com/sacredrealmspod and become a patron. If you've got no rupees, it is not a problem. 5-star Apple Podcast reviews are a great free way to support us. More reviews means that more people see our show. That makes us very happy Hylians. Follow us on Twitter and Instagram at Sacred Realms Pod for updates on the podcast and for behind the scenes action. Sacred Realms will be back next Wednesday with our thoughts on A Link Between Worlds Chapter 4. We'd love for you to play along with us and to share your thoughts on our social channels. A Link Between Worlds can be played on the Nintendo 2DS or 3DS family of systems. But in the meantime, may your hearts be full, may your arrows never miss. We'll catch y'all next week. Sacred Realms is an independent podcast production which is produced, edited, and mixed by me, Lyndon Willoughby. Our music comes from Zelda and Chill by Mikkel and is graciously provided to us by Mikkel and Game Chops Records. Zelda and Chill is available to stream on Spotify or to purchase directly from GameChops.com. Finally, our thanks go to Nintendo for creating such exceptional and innovative experiences.